So from about the age of 9 or 10 years old to 20, around the age of 20, 21, tennis was a major part of my life. It was a massive, gigantic part of my life. And somewhat odd because I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, which for those of you who don't know, it is not necessarily where you would think to play a lot of tennis, more of a hockey kind of a place where we've got two seasons. We have winter and the 4th of July. That's kind of the joke that we like to use up there in Duluth. But regardless, somehow, some way, I became a very competitive tennis player and competed at a pretty high level as a junior, and then had the opportunity to compete at the Division I level. And today, now I'm 46 years old. And I played tennis competitively a couple of times as a grown-up, but have now transitioned into, like everybody else in the world, playing pickleball. And I am extremely grateful, and always have been, for that foundation of knowing how to play a racket sport, because while it's not completely the same, the transition from tennis to pickleball has been a fun one. And I'm a good pickleball player just because of my foundation and as a tennis player. And growing up, I was a Pete Sampras fan. I was an Andre Agassi fan, Jim Courier, Michael Chang. There were all these wonderful American tennis players. And Sampras was the most successful. And when he was on his run towards the end of his career, he had won four straight Wimbledons. And he had, I think at that point, broken the record for most majors. So that's Wimbledon, the US Open, the Australian Open, and the French Open. And then out of nowhere, in the fourth round, Pete Sampras loses. He gets beat by this upstart 19-year-old that I had certainly never heard of. His name was Roger Federer. And I could see it in my mind. I remember watching live on TV Federer winning and falling to his knees. And it was just this crazy moment. We were all shocked that this unbeatable guy, Pete Sampras, on grass loses to a player that we didn't necessarily know, this Swiss guy named Roger Federer. And in a lot of ways, the rest, as they say, is history, because Federer then went on to have one of the greatest careers in athletics. Tennis has always been a sport where one person dominates, and Federer dominated for what seemed like a really long time. And not only that, but he was personification of sportsmanship. Just an absolute gentleman. He was stylish. He had a beautiful game. He moved on the court like a ballerina. He's a good-looking guy. He looked great in his tennis clothes. That one thing about tennis, it's great. My wife wanted to play tennis just because of the tennis clothes. And he had this one-handed backhand that I was so, I don't know if jealous or envious is the term. I just loved it. to the point where, as somebody who hits two hands on his backhand, I'm like, man, if I could figure out how to hit that one hand, it's just such a pretty, pretty thing. It is, like I just said, it's like watching somebody do ballet or dance on a tennis court. And he dominated and enjoyed so much success. And as I mentioned, was this wonderful ambassador. He spent hundreds of weeks as the number one player in the world. 5 years he finished as the number one player in the world. All told, he won 20 Grand Slams, all extraordinary. And he won the Sportsmanship Award, the Stefan Edberg Sportsmanship Award, 13 times on the tour. So universally agreed upon, Roger Federer, great human being, amazing player. Seemed like an unbeatable player for a long time until Rafael Nadal shows up on the scene. This guy from Mallorca, which, gonna be honest, I wasn't sure where that was. But Rafa, as he goes by, is relentless. Holy cow. Relentless. If I had to pick, who would I? If I had to pick between somebody I would want to play, they would all both destroy me. I wouldn't win a single point against either one of them, but I would not want to play against Nadal. He's just so relentless, so physically imposing and intense, and really relentless. Never stopped, never gave up on a point. Like every point was the most important point, also known as match point. And that was Rafa. And he was a clay court player, and everybody thought, oh, okay, he'll just dominate clay courts. Well, though, not so fast there either. He became one of the best tennis players of all time, and certainly on every surface, meaning clay courts, grass courts, hard courts. You get the idea. So Federer was on top forever, and then comes Rafa, and what a rivalry they had! What incredible matches they had! The thing about tennis, I have an immense bias towards tennis, but I believe it to be one of probably the pinnacle of individual sports. You'd say boxing or fighting, but boxers and fighters have corner men or women, meaning their coaches get to talk to them between rounds. There's no finer expression of competition than getting locked into a cage. If you're a UFC fan, mixed martial arts, or stepping inside of the ropes of a boxing ring where it's you against the other guy or gal, and you are literally trying to stop the other person's ability to continue functioning, you're trying to hurt the other person to win. To win means you're going to hurt the other person. Crazy. Tennis. There's no coach. So you're out there on your own. There's no caddy. Think about golf. You've got a caddy that's with you, that's handing you clubs, and you're talking through each shot. Not how it goes with tennis. Tennis combines, it's an incredibly technical game, which means you have to be extremely highly skilled and execute lots of different kinds of shots on lots of different kinds of surfaces. It demands extreme cardiovascular fitness. Everybody's in super good shape. And then it's the mental side of tennis, which is probably the most important. So these guys and these gals are on an island. They are out there competing against one another, and it's personal and it's business and it's all these things. So what would you think? If you were Federer, you're on top of the world, and all of a sudden this other guy shows up and he's in many ways better than you are. Would you be resentful? Would you dislike him? Would you hate him? Would you wish ill upon him? You certainly couldn't blame somebody for doing that. But how did it go? How did this relationship end up? And the reason that I'm talking about this is because Nadal, Rafa, is retiring. If he's not already made the decision to retire, it's really close. He's talked about it. And Federer retired a couple of years ago. And I was on X, formerly known as Twitter, the other day, and I saw a post from Roger Federer to Rafael Nadal. And it was just the most wonderful thing I'd seen in a long time. And so I wanted to share that because it's highly possible you did not see it. And then talk a little bit more about how it shows up in other aspects of life and business. So Federer posts on X, says, "Vamos, as you get ready to graduate from tennis, I've got a few things to share before I maybe get emotional. Let's start with the obvious. You beat me a lot, more than I managed to beat you. You challenged me in ways no one else could. On clay, it felt like I was stepping into your backyard, and you made me work harder than I ever thought I could just to hold my ground. You made me reimagine my game, even going so far as to change the size of my racket head, hoping for any edge. I'm not a very superstitious person, but you took it to the next level. Your whole process, all those rituals, assembling your water bottles like toy soldiers in formation, fixing your hair, adjusting your underwear, all of it with the highest intensity. Secretly, I kind of love the whole thing. because it was so unique. It was so you. And you know that. And you know what, Rafa? You made me enjoy the game even more. Okay, maybe not at first. After the 2004 Australian Open, I achieved the number one ranking for the first time. I thought I was on top of the world, and I was. Until 2 months later, when you walked on the court in Miami in your red sleeveless shirt, showing off those biceps, and you beat me convincingly. All that buzz I'd been hearing about you, about this amazing young player from Mallorca, a generational talent, probably going to win a major someday. It wasn't just hype. We were both at the start of our journey, and it's one we ended up taking together. 20 years later, Rafa, I have to say, what an incredible run you've had, including 14 French Opens. Historic. You made Spain proud. You made the whole tennis world proud. I keep thinking about the memories we've shared, promoting the sport together, playing that match on half grass, half clay, breaking the all-time attendance record by playing in front of more than 50,000 fans in Cape Town, always cracking each other up, wearing each other out on the court, and then sometimes almost literally having to hold each other up during trophy ceremonies. I'm still grateful you invited me to Mallorca to help launch the Rafa Nadal Academy in 2016. Actually, I kind of invited myself. I knew you were too polite to insist on me being there, but I didn't want to miss it. You've always been a role model for kids around the world, and Mirka and I are so glad that our children have all trained at your academies. They had a blast and learned so much, like thousands of other young players. Although I always worried my kids would come home playing tennis as lefties. That's funny. And then there was London, the Laver Cup in 2022. My final match meant everything to me that you were by my side. Not as my rival, but as my doubles partner. Sharing the court with you that night, sharing those tears, will forever be one of the most special moments in my career. Rafa, I know you're focused on the last stretch of your epic career. We will talk when it's done. For now, I just want to congratulate your family and team, who all played a massive role in your success, and I want you to know that your old friend is always cheering for you and will be cheering just as loud for everything you do next. Rafa, that. Best always, your fan, Roger. What an endearing, endearing thing. Making me want to cry, for goodness sakes. Maybe it's a tennis player thing, just a big softy. But after all of that, after a lifetime of tennis together, you know, Federer talked about how Rafa made him a better player. And in spite of the fact that he beat him more than Federer beat Nadal, and they had some of the greatest matches, they're some of the best friends. And that is an absolutely incredible thing. So much to be taken from that, the two people that you wouldn't expect to have forged this incredible friendship that goes well beyond the lines of a tennis court or anything like that. It's just profound. And so I was curious, where else is this showing up? Because it does seem like, or we do live in a very, very kind of polarized world right now, where it's in-group, out-group, it's good team, bad team. That's kind of the whole thing. But not showing up there. Not showing up there. So, Abraham Lincoln, I think that it's probably the next best, well, the best. Lincoln's approach with his team of rivals is probably better than Nadal having a good relationship with Federer. Let's think we can probably go ahead and agree on that. So, Lincoln included some of his major political rivals in his cabinet upon being elected president. And there was a book written by Doris Kearns Goodwin called Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. And his decision to include his rivals in his cabinet was indeed a strategic one. He believed that surrounding himself with strong, diverse perspectives would make his presidency and his leadership better. So he brought in William Seward as his Secretary of State. And Seward was a leading contender for the Republican nomination in 1860, which Lincoln ultimately won. Salmon Chase was Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, another competitor for the nomination. And Lincoln appreciated Chase for his financial expertise and his know-how. I believe that Salmon Chase was on the $1,000 bill Or maybe the $50,000 bill. There's a huge bill. I think it was 50,000. And it was never necessarily used in circulation, but it was used by the Treasury during the Civil War to be able to obviously move money efficiently. That was when we actually had where paper money meant something. It wasn't just, that was before the days of just printing money like we do now. So you actually had to move money around. And anyway, that's sort of a deep cut there. Edward Bates was Lincoln's attorney general, also a former rival of Lincoln. So by including his political enemies, his rivals, he ensured his administration represented a wide range of views. That's the danger of our political system when you have just two parties. You've got Republicans, Democrats. And what we just are experiencing right now is that the Republicans are now going to control the executive branch, which is the presidency, but also both houses of Congress, so the House of Representatives and the Senate. And currently, the Supreme Court is comprised of more conservative, which are considered to be Republican, leaning judges. So the danger is, well, are you just going to end up isolating half the country? And how is that serving anybody? Everybody needs to feel represented. And Lincoln recognized that. Said, how do we help people that their guy didn't win or their gal didn't win? How do we still help them to feel as if they are being represented? And so Lincoln certainly did that. Now, it wasn't just Lincoln. George Washington did that as well. He included a lot of his ideological rivals in the cabinet as well. He brought in Alexander Hamilton as his Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson as the Secretary of State, and they had massive disagreements, literally legendary disagreements, but those competing views helped to shape and strengthen the United States of America. FDR also did this. He appointed political opponents from across the spectrum during the Great Depression and WW2 to foster unity. He brought in a Republican to serve as the Secretary of War. He brought in another Republican to serve as the Secretary of the Navy. Winston Churchill, he developed a wartime coalition during World War II in order to reunite the country. So he brought in members of competing or the opposition parties, which are the Labor Party. But he took a bipartisan approach, just recognizing having different ideas, having different philosophies, different approaches is, could be, can be a positive thing. Just different for the sake of being different is not a positive thing. But recognizing when it does become additive, it's a really powerful thing. Mandela did it in South Africa. He had a government of national unity. After apartheid fell, Mandela was the first black president. He included members of the former regime, F.W. de Klerk, last president. He actually served as Mandela's deputy president. He had a very inclusive government that symbolized reconciliation and nation building. And if you know anything about Nelson Mandela, that he's able to do that after what they did to him, amazing. What a human being. My goodness. Obama also included some of his opponents. He included Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State. He retained Robert Gates, was a Republican from the George W. Bush administration. So there's lots of examples throughout history, even going so far back. Well, you could point to, I'm sure, many, many historical examples, but in contemporary history, the provisional government in Russia in 1917. After Tsar Nicholas II, the provisional government included lots of different kinds or lots of different people from different parties, different affiliations in order to try and get the country moving in the right direction. So, and it's not just politics. There's certainly a lot of different examples of this in business as well. Steve Jobs hired John Sculley away from Pepsi. John Sculley was CEO of PepsiCo. They're very, very different. They had different management styles, different skill sets, different approaches, and Jobs recognized that. Sticking with Steve Jobs, when they acquired Pixar, it was a different tough deal, and Jobs invited rivals to sit on the board, and that allowed Pixar to grow and evolve into the powerhouse that we know it to be today. Satya Nadella, who became the CEO of Microsoft, he brought Bill Gates back into the fold. In 2014, he reintegrated him as a technical advisor. So Howard Schultz with Starbucks, he's obviously the visionary leader, founder of Starbucks. He brought in somebody named Kevin Johnson, who is a tech executive. He eventually went on to succeed Howard Schultz. And Schultz recognized that Johnson had expertise in digital technology, so didn't know anything about coffee. But Howard Schultz recognized you don't need to know everything about coffee. What we need is to have some expertise in areas that we're not strong in. Elon Musk is a tough guy to work for, certainly. With SpaceX, his right-hand lady, for the most part, Gwynne Shotwell, definitely contrasting strengths and styles, but they've been able to collaborate and do obviously amazing things. So the list goes on and on and on and on and on. The list goes on and on and on. I think it's a really, really interesting thing that just because you think that people would not like one another does not mean that people do not like one another. It is certainly evidence of a self-assured, confident, competent person that you would bring in your rival, your adversary, people of different political parties, people from different backgrounds, different beliefs, that you understand that doing so will help you. It'll help you to become a better tennis player. It'll help you to become a better president. It'll help you to become a better CEO. So, strange bedfellows often are what are required to do things that are different. Do things the same, you're going to get similar results. And that's not bad. I mean, country's doing pretty well. Some of the companies that I laid out, pretty successful before, but then they went on to do even more incredible things. So, what would Federer's career have been without Nadal? Difficult to say. Difficult to say. Really good, actually. Pretty simple to say. It'd been a really good career. But with both of them together, it turned into a really wonderful thing. Really wonderful thing. Very, very, very memorable matches and moments. Some of the most memorable. And in a lot of ways, this is a celebration of really true, real diversity. When you think about sort of the clumsy, basic, simplistic versions of diversity that we're thinking about today, just your immutable characteristics. I'm a white guy, you're a black guy. I'm a straight guy, you're a gay guy, whatever. Like, yeah, that leads to diversity, but that's not necessarily anything that I have control over. I did not choose to be what I am. I just am what I am. Now, who I surround myself with, their ideas, the way that they approach things, the way that they live their lives, that's where real diversity comes in. And that's what the true power of diversity is, particularly when it comes to politics, when it comes to growing a company. And certainly, if you're able to bring in somebody and learn from your athletic rival, that'll sharpen your game as well. Whole idea of iron sharpening iron. So, how to close this and land it? Congratulations to Rafa Nadal on a wonderful career. Congratulations to Roger Federer on being a absolutely magnanimous, continue to be a gentleman and wonderful ambassador for the sport of tennis, but certainly just somebody that we can all look up to. conducting themselves in a way that is admirable, and we can all aspire to do the same. So get out there, get yourself a tennis racket, pickleball racket, whatever. I guess probably the more mature way to end this episode would simply be to take cues from these people. Take cues from Abraham Lincoln, from Nelson Mandela, from Steve Jobs, from Roger Federer, and recognize that there is such an immense amount to be learned from those who are different than us, from those who, although they approach solving a problem in a different way, are interested in a better tomorrow. They're interested in better results, are interested in leaving the world in a better place. This is, of course, assuming that we're all being intellectually honest and being genuine actors and approaching things from the perspective of wanting to improve, leave the world better than it is that we found it. And I'm confident that that's you. And I encourage you to take that approach and to believe that those people that we maybe don't see eye to eye on, that they probably do share a lot of our values. And that is when we can bring people like that together and we can listen to their thinking and their thoughts and incorporate it and potentially shift or build upon our current perspective and our current thinking and thoughts, then you have the value of diversity right there. Then diversity is truly your strength and not just a bumper sticker. As always, do your part by doing your best.